he says that the there was a the reason there was all these Nazi hunters in that is they were trying to keep in fear and on the run and basically in fear and not to talk a lot of these people who knew what was going on, who perhaps had opposed it with Hitler, opposed some of the plan, some of the way with Hitler.
Now, with Hans Frank, I think you mentioned in your video that he disclosed something about Hitler's Jewish roots.
Yeah, he wrote a book as he was about to be killed called In the Face of the Gallows. It was a pamphlet, And he said in there that in 1935, Hitler sent him down to his birthplace in Austria. Remember, Hitler wasn't even a German. He was Austrian. And it was born on Braunau on the Inn, I think, was the little town he was born in. And he went down to see what could researchers find about Hitler's birth. And he wrote in that pamphlet that he found that Hitler had been, his grandfather had been Jewish, and that this was testified to by several witnesses, and I can't remember exactly what all he said about it. But and it was in some kind of a document. But at any rate, Hitler then, when he went into Austria in 1938, went ahead of the German Nazi forces, bulldozed all of the all of the graveyards in the area.
He actually made them an artillery practice yard, I think.
Yes, and destroy all the baptismal records and all this type of a thing and all the birth records. So as my friend says, when we find someone destroying evidence, we usually call them guilty. Now, that isn't to say that it's guilty to be Jewish, but the point is, if Hitler was trying to hide that he was Jewish because that would ruin, take the veneer off of him being the world's top anti-Semite, you know, if he was found to be one-fourth or one-half Jewish.
And he always avoided discussing his family history. He said he was the leader of Germany and his family was irrelevant. But you brought up in your DVD, the Final Solution to Adolf Hitler, that William Patrick Hitler tried to blackmail Adolf Hitler. And that many sources all point in the same direction, that Hitler had Jewish ancestry.
Yes, and William Patrick Hitler, who was a part Irish and part German, he did succeed in getting quite a bit of money out of Hitler. And this is actually, I don't know if it's still up, but it was on both the Judith Regan show, which used to be an old show on late on Saturday night on Fox News a few years ago. It was also on Paul Azan. I was interviewing David Gardner, who was the author of The Last of the Hitlers. And I believe if anyone gets that book, The Last of the Hitlers, I believe that the publisher mangled his chapter on Was Hitler Jewish? It is undiscernible. It is like he forgot what he was writing about in the middle of the chapter. But he does get out there, so I think they mangled it. I wish he would have self-published the book. He probably would have got more promotion. But at any rate, one of the things that he says in there is that the Austrian government did an official government study on what was Hitler's ancestry, and Dollfuss, who was the head of Austria at that time, was assassinated by the Nazis, and they concluded, though, that Hitler was the son of a... Now, I don't know if this says this in that book or not. I can't remember, but they concluded, according to something in my memory, and so have other sources, that the reason this Frankenberger, Hitler being the grandson of a Frankenberger Jewish banker, does not... You can never get too much to it, is that the Frankenberger name was a diversion from the real grandfather, which was a Rothschild. And according to a number of sources, and I believe it's also in this new book, Hitler Was a British Agent, the European countries, many of them, would be very fastidious on who was staying at what hotel, who was staying, who was working where. And I remember when we were in Italy in the late 90s, and we had to sign each night that we were there, that we were there at the hotel. Well, anyway, according to some of these authors, the Hitler's mother was registered as working as a maid. His grandmother, excuse me, Schnickelgruber, was a maid at the Rothschild home in, I believe it was Vienna, which I was challenged by this on somebody and said, well, how could she get to Vienna? Well, it was only about 60 or 70 miles away from Linz, where the Schnitzelgruber were living. So, I mean, that was more of a problem back then when cars weren't so prevalent. But I mean, it's not like it's an impossible dream to travel 70 miles to have a good job for a while. But so anyway, that is in a number of these sources that the real reason they trusted Hitler was because he was actually a Rothschild. So I would.
And isn't it asserted that he got sponsorship, or his family got sponsorship through this family?
Well, there's no question. It's admitted in many places that she got some kind of payments from somebody through an intermediary for years. So that, you know, I would not, you know, some of this stuff is very hard to nail down because there's been such a effort to cover it up. And now that we've moved into the next phase, I believe that 9/11, the terror attacks of 9/11/01, there was a World War One, was a big jump forward for this evil world government cabal. World War Two was a big jump forward, but the next really big jump forward was the terror attacks of 9/11, where they now are trying to ramp up World War Three. And now that we're into that phase, I think that some of this, more and more information like this will come out. But I wouldn't bet my life that Hitler was a Rothschild, but it certainly is interesting what I've seen indicating that could be the case, you know.
And how about his involvement with the Jews of Vienna when he was a struggling artist and he needed a place to stay, and he wore a black caftan that was typical of an Orthodox Jew from Galicia or Poland?
Yes, and that's in the book The Jewish Connection, which I mentioned already, by M. Hirsch Goldberg, which I'm trying to look for the year. It's quite an old. It's got to be the 60s. It's quite an old looking book here, and some of that it's 1976 that came out. So if people want to look into that, and William Patrick Hitler, to finish that up, he, according to the this book of The Last of the Hitlers by David Gardner, Hitler brought. He went there and he started to talk about their ancestry. Well, Hitler, according to William Patrick Hitler, brought him in finally, and he's screaming and crying, literally crying tears, and saying, "This has never been mentioned. It was never to be mentioned. Our family. I am just from the folk. I have no family as far as the people are concerned. I am just from the folk." You know.
And now you're quoting Adolf Hitler himself.
That's what William Penn Patrick is quoting Adolf Hitler himself, and he's screaming and crying that they can't mention their family roots. Well, I ask people, do you hide your family roots? You know, are you afraid to say I'm Polish or I'm Irish or I'm Spanish? Is that something normal? Of course, we've seen this emerge over and over again, like Madame Halfbright, what's her name?
Albright.
Albright. For a minute, I was thinking Fulbright. Madam Albright, who became the Secretary of State under Clinton, she was exposed by, I think, an Arab source that she had been Jewish, and she claimed, she's like 60 years old or 65 years old, and she says, "I never knew I was Jewish." She says,
Wasn't Wesley Clark another one? Clark and John Kerry and...
Yes, there's plenty of these people who come up, I never knew I was Jewish. Now, how in the world, can you imagine a Jewish family not telling... someone like Madeleine Albright, they don't know if she's ever going to go anywhere in the world, what their family history was? This is preposterous. And yet, so this is very strange of Hitler trying to hide his family tree. And then in the interview with Judith Regan, which I have on videotape, I don't have it, I don't know if it can be found on the internet, I doubt it, but now with YouTube, I should pull it out and get it up there. Judith Regan says, you have in here that his nephew, William Penn Patrick was the only person ever that blackmailed Hitler, and he said yeah, and he gave him the equivalent of $50,000 and a job for a while and blah blah blah, and she says and he was threatening because he was threatening to go into the family tree and talk about that perhaps part of their family tree was Jewish, and David Gardner says yeah. I mean that's right on. I got to get that up on YouTube. I got so many things taped off over the last year, but I got to get that up on YouTube because it was really a telling moment on television, you know. So,
but
at any rate,
it's so many things, as you point out, so many arrows pointing in the same direction. Weren't there newspapers at the time that Hitler was coming to power that said, why is this Jewish man such an anti-Semite?
Yes, and if I remember, that was in the book called, I'm almost, I feel certain it's in. It's on the tape, but it's in the book, Hitler's Vienna, A Dictator's Apprenticeship by Bridget Hamann, H-A-M-A-N-N, in the same section where she's trying to step over and breeze over this Frankenberger rumor that he's a grandson of a Jewish banker. She mentions that many small papers in Germany challenged his credentials to be the lead anti-Semite in the world because of the fact that he was, they were saying that he was part Jewish. And she also mentions that the graveyards around his house had Hitler's with the Star of David on it, and that some, one of these small papers unearthed a cookbook that was written by a Rosalie Hitler that was Jewish recipes, and was made clear that this Rosalie Hitler was Jewish. So,
and Hitler itself is a common Czech Jewish name, is it not?
Now, that I don't know, but I, again, these are the type of facts we need to get in the final revised, or what did the Lord of the Rings do? They'd come out with their movie, then they'd call it the expanded version. if anybody ever gets the expanded version of the Final Solution to Adolf Hitler or some similar DVD done, we got to get all these facts in there, because I was unaware that it was a common name, but it certainly was in the graveyards with Star of David around there.
Well, I know
I don't doubt that you're correct, though.
There were racial theorists who reassured the Jews that Hitler would never harm the Jews because Hitler himself did not live up to the racial standards that he was advocating. And when you watch films of Hitler, you see him surrounded by Jewish-looking people.
That's an interesting point, too. And I think that this thing you mentioned about the fact that he was in the funeral of procession for Kurt Eisner is an extremely telling point. The big socialist Jew after the First World War. I might mention in passing here that my mentor was tipped off by a book called Barbarians Inside the Gates by Colonel Don de Grandpre, or de Grandpre, P-R-E with a little inflection on it. Don de Grandpre, and he's in his 80s now, I think, but he was the head arms dealer under the Ford and Carter administration for a while to the Middle East. And he tells in his book a little about his history. He worked two levels under President Kennedy in 1960. But he wrote this book called Barbarians Inside the Gates, and he's got a chapter in here, and I mentioned in the tape, that is called, it basically brings out the Nazi, it's called, the chapter is called The Nazi Zionist Secret Alliance, and it was in there that my mentor got the that gave him the clue when he said that a lot of these top Nazis were Jewish. That sparked him to begin pulling together a lot of things he already knew. With that little piece, he then began to pull together a lot of the information, 95% of which is what makes up the DVD that we did, The Final Solution to Adolf Hitler. So,
yes, the DVD is fantastic. It provides all kinds of valuable resource materials in one place that would take years to piece together if you had to do it by yourself. I highly recommend getting the DVD if you want to go into the primary and secondary source material, which establishes that the Nazi regime was a Zionist regime.
I also want to, I usually say this when we mention the DVD, though. It is not, except for the first minute where we piece together some footage of Hitler and the crowds in World War II, it is not an action video, okay? It's not like the Terminator or something. It is mainly made for people who are really interested in history, and it's mainly myself sitting there holding up all these books we've been talking about and a lot of other books and pictures and magazines. It goes on for 2 hours and 20 minutes, and so I'm not sure every person would really like the format. People that are interested in history, though, we've got very high compliments from. In fact, somebody said, don't change it ever because this is more convincing. But we are going to do a professional DVD broken into chapters and with a lot more pictures. And with PowerPoint and that, you could do a lot more pictures and maybe some footage. Would love to get that footage of Hitler and the socialist funeral procession, or the communist funeral procession, but just so people are aware of that, it is mainly like a long 2 hour and 20 minute class, and it will be especially of interest to people who are really interested in World War II history. And the reason we did it, though, again, was because it relates to what's happening today. When you realize that the Nazi phenomena was just another Zionist phenomena, then it can help arm people to see through what's happening today. It's very difficult for the average person to conceive this level of deception, and that's one of the biggest problems those of us who are trying to rally the people to fight what Bush is doing and the neocons are doing, is they just can't imagine this level of deception.
But they always question themselves, how could this happen in modern Europe, you know? And,
yes.
And what you've done provides all those answers which are never addressed in the mainstream media. Have you seen, you have seen Lenny Brenner's books, Zionism in the Age of the Dictators and 51 Documents, and he does not say that the Nazis were Zionists per se, but he does establish the Zionist collaboration, which is typical, as you said, of his genre of literature on the subject.
You mean that they don't quite connect all the dots, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, but I have not seen the 51 documents, but I believe, aren't all 51 of those documents, from descriptions I've read, are all proof of the Zionist-Nazi collaboration, right?
Absolutely. And the Zionist hatred, really, the anti-Semitism of Zionists towards the Jewish people.
Yes. Yes, and I have to say that I have felt that Daryl Bradford Smith has brought this out well. That's also where I heard of you, was on his broadcast. He has hammered that home. What are the average, everyday Jewish people, looking at the long view of the last century, what really are they getting out of this, and shouldn't they all reconsider, even though I know there's tremendous pressure on them to stay in line, reconsider, should they be not at least trying to guerrilla warfare this top Rothschild banking operation instead of going along with it?
Absolutely, because the Jews are going to be the victims of the next push. Jews are very concerned that American Jews are assimilating, that they have life too good in America, and that there's no anti-Semitism in America. And you see in the Israeli press, especially the hard-right Israeli press, the idea that they're concerned that American Jewry will be lost to assimilation. Now, historically, when that has happened, the Jewish bankers have promoted anti-Semitism. So it is urgent that the Jewish community become aware of these facts, because they, too, will fall victim once again to these kinds of atrocities.
Well, I mean, it's not me. It's people. There are certain people in Israel who very much fear that the top leaders of Israel are willing to sacrifice one-third to one-half of the Jewish people in Israel to get done their next steps in this thing. I've heard, although I've never, I couldn't cite you the sources, but I've heard that Netanyahu, and when Sharon was alive, and these top Israeli leaders, that their families do not live in Israel. But I don't know that that's true or not, but it would be something that people might keep their eyes or ears open if that be the case. But.
Well, there's biblical precedent for it. I think in Ezekiel and other places it says that two-thirds of Jews must be eradicated in order for the messianic age where the Jewish king will rule the world to begin.
I mean, how satanic. This is just, it's like it's straight out of hell, some of this stuff.
Well, it is straight out of hell, because they actually worship evil. The Jewish faith has a dualism in it, that God also creates evil. And they believe that the world must either become completely good or completely evil in order for the messianic age to begin, and for the Jewish Messiah to ascend the throne in Jerusalem. And there are movements to rebuild the Jewish temple and destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. And they are setting in place. People have to understand that in terms of the Jewish religion, the reestablishment of the Jewish state heralds the messianic age in which the Jews will rule the world and have a one-world government.
Yes.
And that is precipitated in Jewish mythology by a world war, a catastrophic world war. One would even say a nuclear holocaust, which is predicted in Zechariah chapter 14.
Uh-huh.
So it's very dangerous, and it's very urgent that people understand historically what has happened and the precedents that have been set and how these people operate.
Yes, yes. And that this idea that we should attack Iran, it's constantly floated now in the press that we should attack Iran and even attack them with a nuclear weapon. Michael Savage, whose real name is, you mentioned to me in when we talked a few days ago, is Michael Wiener. He is a talk show host on about 300 stations who always claims he's being persecuted. I mean, I don't think they're going to be giving you or me a 3-hour show per day on 300 AM stations. But he has called repeatedly over the past year that a nuke be used on Iran or some Arab country, and he said if we would use a nuclear bomb on one of these Arab countries, there would be peace for 1,000 years.
Peace for 1,000 years is a messianic prophecy of the messianic age.
Is that right? Yes.
And note that the Nazi regime was called the Thousand-Year Reich, which is also symbolic of the messianic age, and that Hitler was considered the Messiah by many Germans.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, then that's a good connection. I bring this up, although some people object to it, but there's the Sephardic branch of Jewry, and there's the Ashkenazi brand of Jewry, and the last four letters of Ashkenazi are N-A-Z-I, Nazi. And I believe sometimes a little simple connection like that, while it's not a proof, will stick in people's minds more than a lot of historical things. I'm looking now, I found the Journal of Palestine Studies, which is the spring-summer issue of 1976, and the article in there I was referring to earlier is The Secret Contacts, Zionist-Nazi Relations 1933-1941 by Klaus Polkin, K-L-A-U-S-P-O-L-K-E-H-N. So in case anybody's taking notes and is wanting to go to the primary sources and size up what they think about the take that I'm promoting on this, then that'll give them a chance to track it down anyway.
And I would like to reemphasize the fact that the Nazi Party was a communist party from its inception, in that Nazi is a condensation of National Socialist German Workers' Party, the NSDAP.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that whole thing grew out of the Thule Gesellschaft and other crypto-Jewish organizations that were trying to create an anti-Semitic party that would force Jews into segregation and would help to establish a Jewish homeland in Palestine.
And you're reminding me that in the book by Cardell, which is the Adolf Hitler, founder of Israel, my mentor makes a big deal out of a passage where he is talking in a cafe. Now, a lot of the book by Cardell seems to be anecdotal, so some people might challenge it. But he has talks about an incident where Hitler met Trubisch Lincoln in a cafe to get some money or something like this.
Now, Trubisch Lincoln was a Jew named Moses Pinkelus, who had the most bizarre career of any person I've ever explored their history. He was a Canadian member of parliament, I think, a British member of parliament. He financed Adolf Hitler. He bought the Völkischer Beobachter, which was Hitler's propaganda paper, from Dietrich Eckart, who was with the Thule Gesellschaft, the Thule Society, and I think it was called the Münchener Beobachter, when he bought it. Now, this was a Jew working with Jewish financiers to buy Hitler a propaganda organ to use as a mouthpiece for anti-Semitism.
And that's the point. The exact point you made is exactly what my mentor emphasizes, that at some point Trubisch Lincoln says to Hitler, anti-Semitism is only useful in the hands of us Jews. Now, somebody could say, well, can Cardell prove that incident? Well, whether he can prove it or not, this has proven, this is really a mind bender, though, for people to get their mind around, that the Zionists themselves want anti-Semitism. They want that. A simple example that maybe many people have seen of over the years, if Phil Donahue or this one or that one has a show, you'd never have someone like yourself or someone who can really speak on this issue intelligently on the panel. You have a guy wearing a Ku Klux Klan uniform. You have a guy wearing a Nazi uniform. You have a skinhead who's very inarticulate, so that they can rev up this idea of a mindless anti-Semitism, or even a genetic anti-Semitism that every non-Jew in the world has to guard against. But a more astounding example, and many of the people who are around my age or older will remember this incident. In 1972, there was a big, gigantic incident in Skokie, Illinois, which, of course, the Jewish press picked up, the big TV stations, all Jewish-controlled, and really drummed into our heads nationwide, and I was not onto any of this stuff. I was 19 years old, and I remember thinking, what kind of barbarian idiots would want to march, would want to put on Nazi uniforms and march through a Jewish neighborhood. These guys are really a threat to America. Now, it turned out when this was all over that the head of the, quote, Nazi party up there in Skokie, Illinois, was a fellow named Collins, who ended up eventually being pleading guilty to pedophilia as well. But he was Jewish, okay? That eventually came out. That's on the Internet. You can find that in many places. So here we have an example of a completely contrived incident up in Skokie, Illinois, where there was a big Jewish community, of some Jewish guy leading a, quote, Nazi movement, where they had all the Nazi uniforms up, and they were demanding a permit to march through the center of the city. And the Jewish press gives this full-blown coverage like it's a crisis. And never did they, of course, report that the head of the Nazi movement there was Jewish. That's just one example where the whole thing, when you find out all the facts, looks like it was all a complete staged play-acting event to give the impression to everyone that anti-Semitism is and mindless anti-Semitism is just alive and well, you know.
And Henneke Cardell, to come to his defense, we have Trebitsch, Lincoln, Moses Pinkelis' autobiography. We have accounts from Douglas Reed. We have accounts, I forget the German's name, who knew Moses Pinkelis. And all of them say essentially the same thing, that Moses Pinkelis marched in the Nazi marches. He provided them with funds. He bought the newspaper for Hitler, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They were the motive force behind the Nazis. They created the Nazi Party. They created Nazi Party ideology. It mirrors exactly Zionist ideology. And Theodor Herzl, in his diaries and in his writings, said that anti-Semites are our best friends, that we need only rely upon anti-Semites to fulfill all that we want done as Zionists. And yeah, it's documented in his own words. He befriended anti-Semites and praised anti-Semites.
Yes.
And he is credited as the founder of political Zionism, but he was anticipated by Pinsker and Moses Hess, and the real motivating force behind all of it from the early 1800s on were the Rothschilds.
This has been, and Moses Hess wasn't here on 1825, and didn't he...
1860s is when he was publishing on Zionism.
When was it?
1860s, and he was a communist, and he created National Socialism. And he was
an
associate of Marx.
Didn't he talk about the need for communism and Nazism, I believe?
Absolutely. He founded National Socialism. I think he even called it National Socialism, which is the root word of Nazi.
Yes, yes.
And he predicted a race war, and he predicted that Jews would have to suffer in order to be reestablished in Palestine. And he was one of the ones who pushed very much the idea that the Jewish people themselves would have to act as Messiah. That they would be the ones, it wouldn't be a singular king who would restore the Jews to Palestine. It would be the Jewish people collectively who would be the Messiah for themselves.
Yes.
And he said that all the messianic prophecies derive from the racial instincts of the Jews. And he said that the Germans had their own racial instincts, and that there had to be a clash and a race war in Europe in order to establish the Jewish state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now Moses Hess is someone very few people have heard of who was talking about this stuff almost, 80 years before Hitler anyway. Now, I just found the book, kind of going through things here as we're talking, The War, A Concise History, 1939 to 1945 by Lewis L. Snyder, forward by Eric Severide, who was almost as famous as Walter Cronkite in the 60s as a CBS commentator. He would come on and do little commentaries near the end of the CBS News. And in this book, as I remember, and I remembered correctly, concentration camp is not in the appendix, neither is Holocaust. I don't know if it's mentioned anywhere in the book. Perhaps it could be mentioned in a sentence, but the whole book is called A Concise History of World War II, came out in the 1960s, let me see if I can get the year, and it doesn't even mention, I mean, this is the type of thing where people should have, it came out in 1960. And people should, you know, kind of scratch their head. Remember, too, that President Kennedy gave one of his Profiles in Courage chapters to Senator Robert Taft of Ohio, the son of President Taft, for challenging the legitimacy of the Nuremberg trials under international law. Along these lines as well, just, again, we're throwing out facts, I think, to get people thinking and researching. the people should think about this. Schindler's List, which Steven Spielberg made into a famous movie. Incidentally, despite his tremendous talent as a filmmaker, Indiana Jones and all that, Steven Spielberg never won an Academy Award until he did the Schindler's List. And that year he won every Academy Award. So I guess they were holding out on him till he did what they wanted him to do. But Schindler's List, if you can get an early edition of the book, I don't know if it's still on there, but you can get an early edition of the book. It is in the fiction section, and it says fiction in the beginning of the book. I remember around the time of that movie, or a few years after, I was walking to a little grade school basketball game that one of my sons was playing at, and the lady taking the tickets just looked like a normal housewife lady. She was reading Schindler's List, so while she took put it down to get my pictures, I picked it up and I went to that page and I said, "Did you look at this? It's in the fiction section." And she said, "Oh." I said, "Yeah, it's an interesting thing that this is a work of fiction that is passed off as all fact." So at any rate, there's all these, and in that movie, Schindler's List, Spielberg didn't even attempt to show how the gas chambers worked. They just kind of asserted it was happening and showed people outside waiting and so forth. But at any rate, I mean, these are all just little things that hopefully will help people to start thinking and researching a little bit.
Well, my anecdotal recollections are that in the 70s, I think it was, there was a TV miniseries about the Holocaust. And that is when the whole thing exploded.
Yeah, that was 77 or 78. I think it was 1977. It was a miniseries, four nights in a row, called The Holocaust, that I believe starred Meryl Streep, I think.
And before that, whenever World War II was discussed, it was mostly fighting between the Japanese and the Americans, or fighting between the Americans and the Germans. The persecution of the Jews was a very minor element in discussions of World War II.
And a lot of people remember that in the 60s, something impossible to imagine today, and I don't see reruns on it anywhere to speak of, Hogan's Heroes was a whole comedy series about Americans in a prison of war camp in Germany, and Hogan, who was Bob Crane, him and his gang of Americans would always be outsmarting Colonel Klink and Schultz, his assistant, in the concentration camp. But it was a comedy.
Yeah.
And that's unthinkable today. I don't even know what they were doing back then, putting that on, how that got
well,
on.
But
it was a complete comedy, and it was no, as far as I remember, there was never any reference in that, of course. Well, I mean, not that that's that great of a point, but they didn't mention anything about the Holocaust as it appeared after 1977 in there.
And it's gotten so bizarre that, well, who was it, Dick Durbin couldn't even make a comparison between one thing and the Nazis?
Right. Then it became a, yeah, he was like a, well, that's the same as if you remember after the O.J. Simpson trial, Johnny Cochran in his summation of argument, his summation before the jury, did some kind of analogy to slavery and to the Holocaust about the persecution of O.J. Simpson, and afterwards the Jewish attorney who was on there from the beginning, whose name's escaping me at this second, came out, and right after the trial and O.J. was acquitted, he came out and did a press conference and says, "I have quit the defense team in protest of Johnny Cochran debasing the Holocaust by using it here." So in other words, it's like they want a copyright on being able to even use the Holocaust. And that reminds me, Holocaust is a very damaging word for the Jewish establishment, the Zionist establishment, to be using. A Holocaust in the Old Testament and everywhere else I ever heard of, you take something that's valuable to you, like in the Old Testament it might be a spotless lamb, you sacrifice it, kill it, sacrifice it to God to appease God or to get something that you want. So when they insist on using the word Holocaust, that means that somebody took something that was theirs and sacrificed it to God. And that tends to point to what we're saying in this program, that it was the top Jewish bankers who took a part of their people and sacrificed them to God to get some things or something that they wanted. So I think their use of the word Holocaust is a very damaging use of the word if they're trying to convince us that it was an external persecution of the Jews.
Absolutely. And also I would mention that the word Holocaust was first used in the Armenian Genocide, and it was repeatedly used to describe the Armenian Genocide, and today influential Jews resent the fact that the Armenian Genocide is referred to as a genocide or as a Holocaust. That's just a
because they want to want a copyright on it or something.
And they were. It was also World Jewry, which was behind the genocide itself.
Yes. In Armenia.
Yes, they want to minimalize it, trivialize it.
I see, yes. Well, this is like when, I don't know if you remember when they were revving up the propaganda against the Passion of the Christ by Mel Gibson, the movie. After 50 years, the B'nai B'rith and the Zionist establishment finally found a movie they didn't like. They never objected to all the senseless violence or the promiscuity, but they finally found a movie they didn't like based on the New Testament, and they were screaming to high heaven. And at one point, then somebody found out that Mel Gibson's dad, Hutton Gibson, did not approve of the Holocaust. Did not approve of the official version of the Holocaust. He was saying that it had been mischaracterized and was exaggerated. He certainly never denied the Holocaust. Denying the Holocaust would be like denying the 20th century. And this is, they try to use this to make anyone who disagrees with their official version appear to be a mindless idiot. But Hutton Gibson was just saying, and then, you know, that it was some things, details or the characterization was distorted. So then they went after Mel Gibson, and somebody in an interview, do you agree with your dad? And he said something like, well, I don't know the numbers, but, you know, there was a lot of people killed under the Nazis. There was 20 million people killed under Stalin and the Ukrainian Holocaust. They were Ukrainian mass murders. Nobody mentioned those, but there was, I'm against all these mass killings. And that idiot Abe Foxman of the evil idiot, I should say, from the Anti-Defamation League, came out and said that him referencing the Ukraine, the deaths of all the Ukrainians under Stalin, was anti-Semitic, to compare that to the Holocaust.
That's absurd. And there again you have the influence of Lazar Kaganovich, who was a Jew who was the power behind the throne of Stalin.
Yes. Yes, and who orchestrated a lot of the mass murder, did he not?
Absolutely, the planned famine.
Mm-hmm.
They were burning wheat crops when people were starving. It was completely deliberate.
Yes, yes.
And in the early years, a lot of people romanticized Trotsky and Lenin as the good communists, and they say that Stalin was the bad communist, but Trotsky and Lenin killed tens of millions of people and mass murdered the intellectual elite, as you said, and destroyed the army and the police, and they were really terrible. I mean, people conceived of the French Revolution and the terror that followed that as bad, but it was nothing compared to the Russian Revolution and the Jewish Bolshevik terror which followed the Russian Revolution.
Yes, yes. And to maybe tie some of this to today's headlines, at least I'm persuaded that the fall of communism in 1989, so-called, was a final victory, you might say, of the Trotskyite, more urbane banker-type communist, more sophisticated type communist, over the more crude Stalinist type communist. You might remember that on Christmas Day, I think it was Chinesko of Czechoslovakia was murdered and shot on Christmas Day. Suddenly all these guys who had been dictators of communist countries were being done away with if they didn't step down. And the Trotskyites are the neocons. When you hear neocons, the neocons, a lot of Jews such as Irving Kristol, Norman Poteritz, and a lot of them, there was a whistle was blown almost, and tons of Jews converted to evangelical Christianity and became Republicans in 1972. I had heard, and this is anecdotal, but I had heard from someone who studied these things that once there was no computerized vote consolidation as there is since 1988 in the United States, but there was almost no computer. I don't think there were any computers in 1972. That began about 1973. But when Nixon defeated McGovern so thoroughly, it was the greatest landslide in history. I was told that the top Jews said, well, the Americans are never going to go for liberalism and communism. So they then started to infiltrate the conservative movement. And by the time Pat Buchanan ran in 1992 and 1996, he was an outsider in his own party, as it was already controlled by the neocons, who had taken over while Reagan was giving conservative speeches. They were taking over and intertwining Israel with the United States completely. And basically, Bill Kristol of William Kristol of the Weekly Standard is the son of Irving Kristol, who was an open Trotskyite in the 30s. And it's another subject, but the financial consolidation that's happening at the top of our country. Right now, as we do this interview, gas prices here in Cincinnati are $3.50 a gallon. And there's all kinds of monopoly things happening in industries. Well, this is communism. Again, Pope Pius the 11th, in 1931, in an encyclical Quadragesimo Anno, said that monopoly communism and monopoly capitalism drove people into being more sympathetic to listening to the communists. But basically, he didn't say it in these exact words, but monopoly capitalism and communism are the same thing. It's a few people at the top, if they can get away with it, controlling the vast majority of resources and keeping people at the bottom, basically without resources, without land, and having to deal with these monopolies. And
it's collectivization.
So, yes, collectivization. In fact, my mentor explained to me along these lines that, well, what is this word communism? He said that what Stalin succeeded in doing when he took over there was the time when everybody in Russia, all the farmers owned their own equipment, and they farmed their own farms and so forth. Well, the communists went in and took away their equipment. They somehow said, we now own everything. You work for us. And you may remember that they would always have these 5 years plans that never did any good because everybody was feeling like slaves instead of owners. And the taking away of the private equipment and the private farms by force, you know, with the threat of murder and military force, that was the communization. Now they all lived on a big commune where the top monopoly capitalists or communists owned everything, and they were just in the communes. And the same, I tell people quickly to say, show people how this is going on now in the United States, thanks to the Zionist control of all our money and a lot of things that would take another show to go into. Your grandfather owned his own hardware store. You work for Home Depot, okay? Your grandfather owned his own restaurant. You work for TGI Fridays. Now, that doesn't mean that there can't be. The United States is not completely subdued yet. We're not in a complete monopoly capitalist situation. And I don't know if they ever intend to push it that far as long as they control the direction of affairs. But I hope that little section we just went over, this little last few minutes, will help people to see that, yes, the people that are now gaining control of the United States are exactly analogous to the communist Jews who took over Russia in 1917. Even with this Russian Jew, descended from Russian Jews, Michael Chertoff, who's trying as fast as he can as our, quote, head of Homeland Security, our head of Homeland Security, he's trying to institute a police state in the United States as fast as he can and as much as he dare to do.
And they're also attempting to internationalize the North American continent as they have internationalized the European continent.
Right, which is to destroy the United States and all the other countries as sovereign entities. As Pat Buchanan said in 1992 and 1996, they want the United States of America to just be a province in the New World Order. And there's a lot of people, I guess we could call brain dead today, but I do not understand the conservatives who are still waving the flag and rah-rahing for Bush when they find out, just when they see that he didn't try to close the border for 6 years when the Republicans controlled all three houses. It's astounding that Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh has so many brain-dead people still following them and singing the praises of Bush.
Well, one thing I wanted to mention was that David Ben-Gurion predicted the fall of the Soviet Union and what is happening in America back in the 1960s in Look magazine. So that establishes that it was done according to plan. And
that was 1962, I think, right?
Somewhere around there, yes. It may well have been 1962.
That is. I think you can search that on the internet. Look magazine, David Ben-Gurion, and he had the year a little bit off. I think he said
early 80s or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. But he predicted pretty much what happened around 1989. But it's very interesting to read that, and he was. It was an amazing prophecy, you might say.
Well, a little too amazing. And there was a Zionistic Jewish leader named Meir Kahana who was trying to bring the U.S. into war with the Soviet Union in order to force the Soviet Union to give up Russian Jews to Israel. and we almost entered into World War III as a result of those machinations. And that was in the early 1970s when many Jews became supposedly Republicans.
Yes, yes, yes. Some other things are popping into my mind if we have time. People might be saying, I don't know, are these guys... Or they just they themselves just anti-Jewish, and they're just making up as many hateful things as they can with regard to the Jewish religion. I would recommend them to go read the books of Israel Shahak, that's S-H-A-H-A-K, who died a few years ago, I think at the age of 89 or 90. And he was a Jewish professor in Israel who wrote a number of books, one of which is called Jewish History, Jewish Religion, in which he exposes all these things that are part of the Talmud. And he says, basically, look, everybody can get at these facts now these days. There's so much way to research. It's even more truer on the Internet, which is, and he says, we got to drop some of these things that have been weighing us down for 3,000 years, like non-Jews are not human and all this type of stuff, or that it's okay to kill non-Jews in certain circumstances. And so Israel Shirhak was, you might say, what some people call a righteous Jew. I don't know if that's the best terminology to use, but someone who came out and basically exposed all these putrid things that are in the Talmud. And
well, right up until the Holocaust, 90% plus of Jews were anti-Zionists, strongly anti-Zionists.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
The Jewish international Jewish community was taking advantage of emancipation to enter into the professions and to assimilate around the world.
Uh-huh.
And it was the Zionists who perpetrated the Holocaust and who tried to change that trend. And that trend is again happening, at least in America. I wish that the Israeli Jews would get some sense, name their borders, settle down and live at peace, and stop this madness of trying to create greater Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And Israel Shahak's books are available for free on the Internet, and you can get to them through JewishRacism.com if you click on the books page. You'll see both of Israel Shahak's books, and they're very good. And one thing I wanted to ask you about in that context, I remember in your DVD, The Final Solution to Adolf Hitler, you bring up Israel Shahak and his description of the medieval rabbinical culture that tried to keep the Jews within the fold and within the control of the rabbis.
Yes, and that's what my mentor says, that the ghettos in that were primarily wanted by the rabbis, that they liked, this allowed them to keep control of the Jewish people and so forth. That is in his books. Now, another book that maybe people might wish to look at to say, you might say a Jewish source rather than someone who they might, people who are new to this subject or these subjects, this is mind-bending information. I mean, many people have believed some of these distortions or lies their entire life, and it's really a tough thing for many people. So another book is called Israel Sacred Terrorism, which I believe is also on the Internet, and it was, the foreword is written by a Palestinian woman, Livia Rocock, but it is the diaries of the second prime minister of Israel, whose name was now his name's escaping
Moshe Sharat, I think.
That was it, Moshe Sharat, Sharatt. And he basically was one of the more, I would say, the humane side of the leadership in Israel, or at least he would say, we can't do that. We can't. This is going to backfire. You know, blah blah, and. He then in his diaries he would kind of say, "Oh, that worked too." You know, he would be advocating the more humane policy, but then he would be well. Anyway, when he died, then Ben Gurion and some of the others tried to blame everything on him because he was dead. And his daughter got so mad at this, she published his diaries, and the book is called Israel Sacred Terrorism. And this is what, again, you're reading from the second prime minister of Israel, a Jewish source who is telling you, sometimes approvingly, sometimes not approvingly, of what they were doing and how devious it was and how they would try to use terrorism to provoke provoke hatred of the Arab world and hatred of the Muslim world in the United States so that the United States would back Israel all the more.
And very importantly, to use as a pretext to launch wars against their neighbors so that they could acquire territory. He specifically cites Moshe Dayan and others in discussions where it was brought out that they would love to have, they would pay $1 million to an Arab to bomb an Israeli so that they would have a pretext to take over Transjordan and Egypt and Lebanon and Syria and all the nations which form part of what is supposedly promised to the Jews in the covenant with Abraham, which is they refer to as Greater Israel. Israel wants to expand vastly from the Nile River to the Euphrates River.
Yes. Another book from a Jewish source that I'm sure you've heard of is The Holocaust Industry by Norman G. Finkelstein, who's a professor and who I hear now is being denied tenure. He's been kicked around from college to college since this book came out. But The Holocaust Industry is called Reflections on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering. Now, this book does not challenge the official 6 million story or anything, but it does take on the ADL and a lot of these groups who have shamelessly tried to make money off the memory of the Jews who were killed in the Holocaust. And it's a very fine and scholarly book to show that when we say the Hollywood version of the Holocaust contains many distorted and exaggerated claims, this is a book for people who would like to read a Jewish source rather than hear two people who aren't Jewish discussing it. Go to that book and take a look at that book. And he also has some other books that are also very valuable. That's Dr. Norman Finkelstein.
And he's caught a lot of heat for what he did, which brings me to what I wanted to ask you. What has been the reaction to your DVD from various communities, both positive and negative?
I have gotten almost no reaction from the Jewish community. Okay, I can't remember if there was any negative. Nothing in my mind sticks out as a negative email or a negative letter or anything like that. I have gotten periodic negative reactions and really kind of frantic reactions from the neo-Nazis and what I call the Hitler worshippers. They'll say, why are you bringing this up? Why don't you leave this history alone? This is, Hitler was doing the best he could and blah, 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 blah. And so it's the neo-Nazis. I don't know how many of them are just playing the Jewish side of the fence with the Nazi thing, and how many. But there's many people who are not Jewish who are very much. I mean, obviously they would. It's a shock to anybody to say there's any Jews that are promoting neo-Nazism, but there are. But a lot of these other people who, again, often have no religion, seem to almost have, agnostics or atheists, seem to have almost a need to keep Hitler in some kind of a worshipful or demigod type of category. And again, I know that the facts for anybody who is not just totally committed to that false view of history, I know that the people that have watched this video that I've heard from are always very grateful that this gives them, kind of puts the whole thing together for them in more of a balanced view. I've said that if people do not have this information that I got from Ratisbon, as he likes to be called, then they have to leave whole sections of World War II out of the picture. They just have to take a lot of the facts and a lot of the events and push them to the side, because they just don't fit any of the, you might say, approved versions on either side of Hitler.
Well, it's amazing how it explains so many things once you hit upon the underlying reasons for what was happening.
Yes, and another thing that I always wondered about that everyone's heard of that studied World War II is Hitler had the British defeated at Dunkirk. I mean, he had their entire navy bottled up, and
he let them go.
He let them go, and so he still said, well, he was making a peace gesture to England because he was so much in favor of Western civilization. Well, okay, but wouldn't it be more effective to just take all the Navy prisoners and hold them as prisoners and take all the ships and start using them and then make the peace overture? Wouldn't that be more effective? So that you
and
could have
why
peace?
Why did Goering take the bait of the British bombing Berlin to cease bombing all the airfields in Britain and start bombing the cities?
Yeah.
way they allowed the invasion of Normandy to happen, and the Omaha Beach and the D-Day.
Yes, I mean, there's so many of these things that when you look at them, the explanations just don't ring true. Now, my friend said that Hitler was trying to win back over the Cliveden Group and the British his allies in Britain and then go where he allegedly wanted to go, which was to a New World Order where they would all be kind of peacefully leading us all into the New World Order or something. But again, these explanations that were given, like Hitler just let him go, these do not make sense. One minute the official historians are saying Hitler's the most ruthless, crazy, power-mad individual in history, and the next minute they're saying, oh, he did something that is probably never heard of in the history of warfare. He had the enemy basically defeated, and he let them all go to give him a nice gesture. Well, both views of Hitler can't be right. He can't be the most magnanimous leader, opposition leader in the history of warfare, and be the most ruthless, crazy, power-mad guy in history. And so, as you say, without this key, it's a little bit difficult to put it all together, I think.
And with the key, it all fits. It's amazing how the picture is completed.
It seems like it, yes. That's how I... And again, we're always open to new information, and a lot of which I learned from you tonight, and some astounding new information. And we're open to that, but because we're... You know, if someone can show that this thesis is off a little bit or this part, well, then let's come forth with the evidence. There's a tremendous, overwhelming body of details. And remember, these details were picked out of books that, except for the Cardell book, Adolf Hitler, Founder of Israel, are not pushing this thesis. They're pushing other theses. But when you look at all these facts in these books, then you have to say, well, the author didn't give an adequate explanation for the facts they presented, see? And that's what makes it, to me, when I looked at it back in 1999, made it much more convincing that suddenly you realize that you knew when you read over them that these facts were not sufficiently explained, like Dunkirk, but it was so confusing you just pushed it out of your mind or pushed it to the back of your mind. At least that's what I did until I ran into this gentleman who gave me all this information.
Are you aware of any other researchers who are pursuing this thesis?
I wish that there were many, and that's why we put this DVD out.
Well, Daryl Bradford Smith is certainly on board with it.
Yes, he was certainly. I don't think we did any shows on it, but maybe we did. I can't remember. But
I was the one who...
Daryl was on board, and so is Eric Hufschmid. I believe he has done some stuff on it as well.
But other than that, you're not aware of anyone?
Well, no. I have always felt, even though I like a lot of the guys that are in the Spotlight American Free Press or David Irving or Ernst Zundel, I've always felt that they, when I heard speeches from that genre, Lady Renouf, if you're familiar with her out of Britain, who's a very striking lady in her 60s, I think almost 60, who looks like she's 40 and very well spoken, but all these people. I always felt that, because I don't have a lot of talents in life, Christopher. If people meet me, unless I'm dressing up, they'll say, he can't address us without a lot of taste or whatever. But I am a propaganda word analyzer. I don't say I'm the best in the world, but I feel like I'm up in the top echelons of propaganda, and I know propaganda when I hear it, or it perks my ear up. I always felt that they were, many of these speakers and so forth from Mark Weber, even of Institute for Historical Review, who I like a lot and has been a tremendous guest for me on my radio shows we've done on the public radio. They try to leave they're trying to leave the audience feeling a little bit better about Hitler. Hitler was a pretty good guy. He's misunderstood. Give him a second chance. It's sometimes very subtle. And I think this destroys their credibility with the large group of people. For one, people do not instinctively, they're not going to go for a cruel program. And when you look at Hitler's program, it was cruel. No matter how you look at it, it was cruel. And he sounded cruel, and he sounded angry, and he sounded threatening when he spoke. And so, if somebody's being unjustly tarred, like Senator Joseph McCarthy, or Father Coughlin, or a lot of other people that we could bring up, I will stand with them to the end, you know. But I'll try to stick up for them at the end. But with Hitler, when the facts do not support that he was doing noble things, why give away our credibility to try to apologize for him in any way? That's where I break with so many of these folks that are otherwise doing a lot of good work, and a lot of whom I like personally that I've met, you know.
And all the Germans that I've met hated Hitler. and said that he destroyed Germany and destroyed Europe needlessly.
You mean the Germans who were there?
The Germans who were there. They viewed Hitler as a curse on Germany.
Well, I know that the Germans who came here and even over there, I know that they're still feeling under duress. They felt completely defeated in many ways and didn't feel they could speak up in America because the propaganda was so great. But I wish that those that are still alive would give interviews or would put their stuff on tape so that they could testify to their firsthand experiences, because these are very valuable, I think, for history. If any of them could put anything on tape or videotape.
Well, I think the Holocaust is a great tragedy, and I think it's a great tragedy that the wonderful history of Germany has been so tarred, because Germany was one of the leading countries in the world up until the Holocaust. They had a beautiful culture. They had wonderful cities. They contributed many things to mankind, and it's terrible that all that be forgotten.
Well, it shouldn't be, and it's got to be put back into balance. I've often said to people, different peoples have different talents. If you were depending on me to build machinery and cars and computers, we would all still be running around in caves and in the jungle. I don't have any ability in that direction. And I often say to people, if it wasn't for the Germanic peoples, what technology would we have? I mean, when you look at it, a lot of the technology we have is overwhelmingly coming from the German people, Germanic peoples anyway, throughout history.
And Germany had been very good to the Jews from Bismarck on,
until
the Zionist Jews financed Adolf Hitler and put him in power. I would say created Adolf Hitler and guided him throughout his terrible career.
Yes. Well, I agree with that. And so again, I just think it was, you know, there is a certain thing where I know a lot of these people that are into the neo-Nazi thing in some way, they think, well, if Hitler was opponent of the Jews, he's a friend of mine. That's kind of their thinking. The facts don't exactly fit that, and again, I have never been, even before I knew all this, and I'm not now, for giving away an ounce or a centimeter of credibility in order to defend Hitler as a noble character when he was actually one of the super criminals of World War II.
Well, on that note, I wish to thank you very much. You've been the first guest on my radio program, and I don't think I could have picked a better one.
Well, that's an awful kind thing to say, and I don't know if that's true, but I certainly am glad to, especially you're going to put this up on the Internet for anybody to hear. I'm glad that we could get all this out, and this is by far the longest interview I've ever done on this subject, and I think that I'm very happy that this will be available to people so that people can download it, listen it, and check out the sources. I always say to people, because I go through life telling people things they find hard to believe a lot of the time on politics and religion and so forth, historical facts and so forth. But I always tell people, don't believe anything just because I said it. Check it out for yourself and do some thinking and some research, some prayer maybe, and some study, and see if you don't think we're very close on the right track, if not exactly on the right track, on almost all the things we've been talking about tonight.
Well, if you get Jim Condit Jr.'s DVD, The Final Solution to Adolf Hitler, everything that he says is sourced, and he holds up the source or a photocopy of the source. He gives you, and you can see the publisher, you can see the date it was published, you can see the author, you can see the title of the work, and he quotes from it. So it is all cited and sourced. Those facts can't be disputed. If anyone disagrees with the logical conclusions drawn, they should raise those arguments.
That's right. And the original website was called FinalSolutionToAdolfHitler.com, but then I found out that HitlerDVD.com was available. So that's what is probably the easiest thing for people to remember if they want to get it, is HitlerDVD.com. Although I'll say quite frankly, while there is more in the DVD, we have covered a lot tonight, and again, we try to sell a few of these DVDs to keep the doors open, but we mainly want to get the word out, so we don't mind at all if someone listens to an interview like this and they go from there, because the most important thing is to get the information out there so people can understand what happened in the past, so they can understand what is happening now with the war on terror and the drive towards World War III in the Middle East and a police state here in the United States.
And many of these sources are found in my book, The Manufacture and Sale of St. Einstein, which can be gotten at JewishRacism.com.
Very good.
Now, you have several other websites which are very interesting. Would you please give those URLs?
Well, with the presidential race in full swing right now, and they're going to try to get everybody nominated in the major parties by February of next year, votefraud.org is a study of the how we are under computerized voting, and every state in the union, except for half of New Hampshire, has delegated every county in the union. There's 3,100 counties and 50 states. Every county except for half of the counties in New Hampshire have delegated the counting power to one of four mega computerized vote counting companies. They're all ruling elite establishment companies. Diebold is a name that has hit the news that people might recognize. Two of the others are Election System and Services, Election Systems and Software, and Sequoia. So on the votefraud.org, you can quickly get up to speed on that. If the powers that be, if this is not exposed and we don't get back the citizens hand counting paper ballots in their precinct, then if the powers that be want to make Hillary Clinton or John McCain or Barack Obama or whoever they want to make president, they will do it by computer and by their news coverage. But ultimately, the computerized count is completely unverifiable, as unbelievable as that seems. There's no citizen verification. In fact, except for half of New Hampshire, if you try to go and look at the votes on election night, you'll find the police barring your way, and you'll be arrested if you try to get in and see what they're doing with the votes. RealNews247.com, that's RealNews247.com, deals with more of the overall picture, and we got on there seven lessons. The homepage has seven lessons we feel that every American should learn right now, and that has to do with 9/11, the war on terror, and so forth. And again, the drive for a police state here in the USA, and the drive for World War III, or an expanded war in the Mideast. And another one we have is networkamerica.org, which gives the plan on how average Americans 10 to 20 hours a year can try to take back, and I think we could go a long way if 30 or 40 or 50,000 people would start pulling in the same direction to take back our country by peaceful constitutional means through the precinct strategy. That's at networkamerica.org, and if you just want to read one short article about 4 pages and 8.5 by 11, click on the most powerful office in the land, which explains the precinct system in 4 pages.
Well, once again, I wish to thank you. All that information is very good and useful, and I wish that some point I can have you back to discuss your plans for taking back the precincts, because I think you have hit upon one of the best solutions for Americans to break the yoke of the Jewish banking establishment, which is subverting our democracy. And it's a civilized, safe, legal, sane approach for the American people to assert their power.
Yeah, it's already in place, it's peaceful, it's constitutional. It's just that we don't know, the average person doesn't know about it. We're not even on the playing field, and we need to get on the playing field, and at that point I think we would begin to win.
Absolutely. As citizens, we're kindergartners competing with doctors, and it doesn't work.
That's exactly right. And certainly any time that you wish to discuss that, we'd be glad to come back and go over it.
Okay, thank you again, and good night, sir.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.